sure they'll kind of like the
recording has started. Thanks for around the room very safe.
So I just start.
You start when you start and you edit it out later.
Cool. Now,
how long is the session?
Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm editing.
Chowing down on chili, bread, honey butter.
Go ahead and get started. How many folks were at the asset-based community development workshop I did yesterday? So I'll do a little bit of background on that because this workshop builds a little bit on that, but it stands alone as well. My name is Ron Dwyer Voss. I'm from Sacramento, California. Moved there 15 years ago after living here for a year and a half or so. And before that, I was in Chicago, where I mostly worked as a community organizer. And then since being in Sacramento, I worked doing community building and community development work in rural communities, Native communities, and in Sacramento as well. In the last 4 years, I've had wonderful opportunities to do my own consulting business, training and coaching organizations, mostly nonprofit organizations, some local governments, in community organizing and community building. And I like that because I get to go places where people gather from all over, kind of like COVID. Beyond Minnesota and Wisconsin, my workshops. I had one workshop with 18 people from 16 different states. Mm-hmm. It was really, you know, from rural Mississippi to the Bronx. So I get to benefit from all their experiences and stories and repackage it into a training, and then people pay me to tell their stories. So, that's my gig and who I am. The yesterday we talked about an approach to community building that I found to be, well, one, it works, so that's helpful. Anybody in the community and helping business likes things that work, because a lot of things don't. And two, it's fulfilling, it's a dignified approach, because it's based on what communities and people have as opposed to what they're missing. It doesn't ignore what's missing, it doesn't ignore problems like gangs or drugs or disabilities or anything that's actually part of people's lives, but it says we're not going to start there. We're going to start with what a community has, what individuals have, what gifts they have to offer, and figure out how we can connect those to build and strengthen community, to then see, once we have all our gifts on the table, once they're connected, what we can do about the other issues that we're concerned about, instead of starting with what we're missing. And for me, it's based on the axiom that I've never seen a need solve a problem. And so why start with needs if you're trying to solve problems? It's also more fun because people engage in it. It's positive and enriching and energizing, as opposed to depressing and leading to burnout. So that's a little bit of what it is. The assets that we focus on generally fall in these six categories. By we, I mean people that engage in this work fairly intentionally. Talents and skills of people in a community, so individual gifts. And of course, Holden is such a great place for that. You have people who maybe work for a computer company come up and they're good carpenters. When Sue and I lived here, we like to say that this was a place where your hobby could become your job. So I liked to cook. I became a lead cook. Most time, nobody knew I had professionally trained. There was a couple of chowders that went really bad. Associations and network of relationships. And that's, in this session too, we'll talk a lot about it, because that's a big one. Associations meaning where people voluntarily gather, not to be paid, but to be with each other out of a common interest. Book clubs, churches, all kinds of things in between. Because those networks of relationships, those places where people gather voluntarily, are where gifts get amplified. Come on in. Come on in.
Sure.
Yep.
Great. Thanks.
Seats right
Sorry.
Here. Come on around. Don't look in the camera. The third set of assets in most communities are institutions and professional entities, hospitals, libraries, schools. It doesn't matter how poor or rich, most communities have these. The difference between some communities and others is how well institutions are engaged with the community and vice versa. Whether everybody just comes into the institution and leaves, or whether they engage with the surrounding neighborhood. Physical assets, land, property, buildings, equipment, park space, open space, trees, all kinds of things. Physical assets and economic assets, which we don't just define as income, but we go a step back and look at what work can people do? What can people produce? And then how can that be organized in a way that's beneficial to the community? And then finally, culture and stories. More and more, when asset-based community development as sort of a description of this approach was coined and practiced, just the first five, but the more and more we went to different communities and tried this stuff, the more we found that the culture of a place and the stories mattered quite a bit in terms of understanding what the gifts of the community were. The culture and stories often contain many gifts. So here's a sample map, or usually this would be a summary map. When we work with a community, we'd go through each of those categories and in a church basement or somewhere, brainstorm what's going around, and these are the kind of things that groups come up with. So when they talk about individuals, they say, who are the individuals in our community? And they'll come up with everything from youth to welfare recipients to students to activists to veterans. Associations. animal care groups, political groups, recreation groups, environmental groups, social groups, women's groups, mutual support groups, communities that engage folks who are meeting at AA and NA and places like that, tap into all kinds of gifts of people who are otherwise feeling marginalized, and amplify their gifts because they have other things to offer. Or yesterday I talked about the Christian Motorcycle Riders Club of Amador County in California, which really narrows the interest of the association, but it turns out they can do a lot of other things, just you have to ask. Physical space is a fairly typical list that people come up with. Gardens and parking lots and walking paths to fishing spots. Local economy. This one a lot of times is hard for people to think about because we're asked so often to think about the economy in a macro sense and GDP and things like that. But when you start thinking about where's money, and where's it in the community, where's it moving around, people come up with lots of stuff, including barter and exchange. There's a lot more of that than we usually recognize. And then the culture and stories, backgrounds and histories, what people like to do, success stories that people have had. When I used to go in rural communities in the Western United States, one of the things we often heard from middle-aged adults and up was a concern that young people were not going to come back. And this was in the 90s when telecommuting became possible and therefore popular, and then there was all these other new people moving in, and they wanted things like stoplights and stuff that nobody had needed before. So there was some culture clash, and usually the first thing he asked to separate what was clashing was, what do you love about your community that you want to keep? And then what do you know is going to change? Let's just acknowledge that and then go forward. Well, the stories that came out of, or how we got to what they wanted to keep, was all described in story. You know, they might want to keep a bridge, not because it was a bridge, but because there was a history and a story and a parade associated with it. And, when the new people heard those stories, then those things had meaning and they understood why that bridge shouldn't have two lanes. So these are the kind of things that show up on that map. And this is not hard to do. They're in the bookstore. Jody Kretzman, who's a Holden regular, in 1987 put a book out that called Building Communities from the Inside Out. And it's in there, it's a green book, and I think it's in the social issues section. It has a lot of examples of how to do this for communities, but also for libraries, for churches, for youth groups, and just tons and tons. It's this thing. A lot of great examples, and then him and his colleagues at Northwestern have put out a number of manuals on how to do this stuff. And I see many communities who, you know, I might be asked to come in and help them move something to the next level, but they've already created, you know, 20 pages of maps, we call them, of basically the lists and then where things connect. Because that's a lot of what you do with this kind of thing once you have it. Otherwise, it's just a list. Except for the disempowering effect of a needs assessment, it doesn't do much more. It sits on a shelf. So it's important in this kind of work to try to take all those things that were up there and connect them. Then there's one thing that I didn't do yesterday. It's important. This is often contrasted with sort of a traditional needs-based model that starts with needs. And like most things, using contrast is helpful to understand, not to judge necessarily. But when we see needs, what's our response usually? Needs.
Look at the cause of them.
Right. cause.
Or to identify them.
Fix them, right? How do we fix most needs we see?
Add something.
Homelessness or hunger.
Add something.
Yeah, we add something. We usually put together some sort of program. So it might be once a week our church opens up and has homeless people sleep, or we might organize a food bank. We might read to children. We get these programs going. In programs that meet needs, people's needs, what is the role of the person with the need in most cases?
Recipient.
Mm-hmm. Right. Other phrases that came to mind or experiences you've had?
Dependent.
Yeah.
Client.
Yeah. I'll use that word intentionally here for a second. It's a passive role for the most part. With a little bit of contrast now, if you're starting, instead of saying, well, we have these needs, these guys are sleeping on the front steps of our church, what are we going to do? We start with a map of assets in the community like that, including people who may not have been in the mainstream circle. Now what might be a response?
Can we use our assets?
Can we use our assets? Okay. How might we figure that out?
Who are we connecting people?
Who are we connecting people? So we want to use, we've identified, but so when you said who are we, what did you mean?
Kind of like with connecting, making sure we know who of the community, who are we, what assets do we bring?
Yeah, to kind of lift up and become aware of them. These things need to be connected, otherwise, again, they're just a list of isolated things. So in that process of connecting people, what's the role of the folks with assets?
Active.
Engaged.
Agents.
Did you say?
Agents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if we're going to keep using this word that much, but it's kind of so politicized. But in the ancient sense, they're citizens. In the old Greek sense, they're actively participating in determining their future. So there's always enough theologians and then I can ask, does anyone know the Greek translation of the word that gave us client?
Greek.
And I've forgotten the word. I didn't know it. Sounds very close to client. It's a word that means one who lays prostrate on the ground. In its literal translation, it was used to describe people who were powerless. It's the most powerless physical position you can be. So clients in the early Greek democracy were people who were powerless, who could not be involved in the decisions that affected their future. And citizens in that culture that gave us that word were men, but the men who were allowed to make the decisions about the future. So part of the contrast in the approach is really comes down to this, because if you're starting here, you generally come up with a orientation that people are the answer, which is vague and messy, not easy to organize, institutionalize, bureaucratize, but it works. And when we start here, we usually end up looking for programs as the answer. And in most places, it's usually a combination of things. And in many places, programs that are designed by and run by the people with the needs but who also have assets are the most effective. I'm working with a group of people right now facilitating their meetings, their mental health providers, and an affordable housing group that built affordable housing units, 60 out of 100, which will be for people who are coming out of homelessness, but were in homelessness because of some sort of mental health issue. Mental health providers, I have property managers, and I have housing developers. And they have to, by law, for the funding they got to do this, come up with a mental health services plan. And in two meetings, the piece I put on the agenda that when they hired me, I promised them I insisted on, which was, who do we invite to these meetings to create this plan that has been through this experience or is in this experience right now, so that it can be authentic? And in two meetings, they have absolutely, in the most classic dysfunctional family diagnosis way, managed to avoid that part of the agenda. Even the people who make their living as mental health service professionals have a mind to go there. So when I get home, we have the meeting where I start with that and get to announce that we're not going any further until we make that decision, or they need to find another facilitator, if they want another top-down client-based program. So that's sort of the approach. For those of you who were here yesterday, did you have reactions to hearing about it, or did I just describe something entirely different and didn't communicate well yesterday? what were some of the thoughts you had after the session yesterday? Especially for those who joined us today. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've never, one of my master's papers in urban planning was on tax increment financing, how it could potentially be used for affordable housing. I've never actually thought about TIF from this point of view, because I generally like them, because they generate resources for a community based on what's going on in that community.
So maybe starting with the negativism, always the wrong way?
No, it's not always the wrong way. You know, if it's the only way, it will become self-reinforcing. If it's the only way, somebody may get some food, which is good, but it may be difficult for them to ever see themselves beyond, or at least see themselves in relation to all the people who do these programs, as anything more than a client, a passive recipient, instead of a potential partner, a potential friend, a potential relationship, a potential provider of help.
Well, in the very least, you're not flexible if you only have one answer to an issue. Or
this
situation.
People burn out of this a lot. Because, you know, when you do this model, you're just going to keep doing this model. And it's very hard to take care of transforming this into where these are more dominant. But I had to think about the TIF thing.
It's interesting that the only...
Do people know what TIF is? It's tax increment financing, where you you freeze the taxes in an area and then borrow money against the new tax revenue, and that way you can invest in it.
Yeah, we in Washington aren't permit, we're the only state in the union where it's constitutionally prohibited.
Yeah, I know.
We have a Speaker of the House who has issues with it, so.
Which state is that?
Washington.
Washington, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Constitutionally prohibited for using TIF?
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. But it has to start out with a blight study.
Right.
You got to go look.
It does. Blight. In fact, in our where Sue and I live, there's a section of our neighborhood that has tried several times to become a TIF redevelopment district because it's really on the cusp. There's a lot of great stores, a lot of great history, but there's also a lot of just empty stores and stuff. There's just some neglect for a long time. And but yeah, they did blight enough. There's this, you know, in the formulas in California law, you know, they took all the acreage and divided it by this and that and the other thing. And there was one particular property owner who actually owns a hayfield in the middle of this urban strip who wouldn't participate in that formula, so it wasn't blighted enough. And that's where this becomes problematic, because if the business owners and people in that district wanted to go here, why not? And if you started here with what they could have to offer, how they might expand in addition to what you might bring into the vacant lots, then it's a whole different approach. And we talked a little bit, you know, sort of a blight study, a lot of times we do needs assessments of communities, which is just a way of saying, but tell me everything wrong with you, and now we'll mirror it back to you and say all the programs and services and things that are going to happen in this community will happen based on what's wrong with you. And therefore, all the agencies and nonprofits who want to make payroll, who want, you know, are filled with good people wanting to do good work, need to structure themselves around what's wrong with the community they're working in if they want to get grant money. So it becomes very self-reinforcing. So you came to a session with rodents in the title. I can't delay any more reading you the story of rats. It's a story by Henry Moore, a late colleague of mine who helped write this book, which is really this combined with the book I referred to before. The book I referred to before talked about, you know, all the different kinds of maps you can make and how you can make them and how you get the information. And this book talks about what you do with the people in the process and how you do the connections.
What's the title again?
When People Care Enough to Act. By Mike Green and Henry Moore. I think it's a great title. This combines asset-based community development and what we know from community organizing and brings them together. So Henry was assistant city manager of Savannah, Georgia in the late 80s and 90s. And many remember in the 80s, one of the main issues plaguing many urban areas was crack cocaine. And Savannah, Georgia was no exception. And he got a $100,000 grant from HUD, didn't ask for it, to help clean up the drug problem in Savannah, Georgia. Not anybody who'd done any work like this, because $100,000 is not going to clean up a drug problem on a block, let alone an entire city the size of Savannah, Georgia. So, sort of out of spite, but also out of his own increasing awareness that the city could not solve this problem, that neighbors and neighborhoods had to solve it, he created a mini-grant program where people could apply for money for materials to do things to improve their neighborhoods. But to do it, they had to talk to the neighbors and come together with a plan. And long story short, they went from having four block clubs in Savannah, Georgia, the year he started this, to 5 years later, 400 block clubs in Savannah, Georgia, people coming together and gathering and improving their community. So after that, he went to work with other communities to help them do different things. And this was one of his experiences. He said, I went to Norfolk, Virginia several years ago to work with a fellow by the name of Curtis Randolph, who is the director of neighborhood services. I was training department heads, helping them to transform the city organization to lead by stepping back, which is one of the principles of asset-based community development, is institutions provide leadership by stepping back and supporting people. So to lead by stepping back and to think about how to lift citizens up and support them in their work. One of the interesting things Curtis told me was that the mayor had won a recent election, and part of his platform was to clean up the public housing project, a project that had a reputation for drugs and crime and so forth. So they had been out meeting with citizens and talking with them about cleaning up the neighborhood. But there was a problem. Citizens would come to the meetings, but they didn't seem to make a lot of progress on the city officials' agenda for cleaning up drugs and crime. Has anyone ever seen that happen? After a number of conversations, they discovered that people in the neighborhood saw a problem with rats. There were a lot of young mothers with babies, and people were fearful that the rats might get into a crib or get into the bed. In fact, they told of an occasion when a rat was seen in the crib, although that time the baby wasn't harmed. This information led the city staff to help public housing residents work to bait the rats. Over a period of 6 to 9 months, they cleaned up the rat problem. And then they noticed that after the rat problem had been abated, citizens in the public housing complex began to get more involved in a number of neighborhood improvement initiatives, including cleaning up drugs and crime. To me, the moral of the story is that if the people tell you the problem is rats, then the problem is rats. It's not crime or drugs, even if crime and drugs seem like the problem to you. Sometimes it's hard for those of us in authority to believe that it's rats, because our briefcases are so full with statistics about crimes and drugs and answers and programs to crime and drugs problems that we can't hear that citizens want to begin with rats. If we want to succeed at mobilizing citizens, we have to close up our briefcase full of answers for a while and open up our ears. That's Henry's "If it's rats, it's rats." What are your thoughts about that story? What did you hear in that story?
It's all about listening to their stories. Yeah. Yeah. Bottom line.
Listening.
You gotta hear them.
Listening, hearing.
And your biggest problem.
A very wise man said, "That's why God gave us one mouth and 2 ears."
Twice as much time listening, not defining people's problems from the outside. People are very aware of what they want to work on.
Starting with something more manageable, too, in building a rapport or trust or a track record in some small way.
Yeah.
Sense of accomplishment.
I think it's also empowering, because instead of going and saying, "Oh, here's your, we've decided this is your problem," but you're empowering them to define their own, for you to tell you what their problems are. And you listening to that, that's empowering to them, because it's sort of bottom up rather than top down.
Yeah, very much so, which reinforces. It's definitely my experience, when you train people in community organizing, you tell them, try to help people start with something doable. And to listen to what those things are. Because I'm quite sure that part of the reason, at least in my experience, that people originally weren't doing much with the presentations on how to deal with drugs and crime was because they felt a little overwhelmed by that. That's a classic thing. Planners face all the time. They do community meetings, come out and present, here's the 9 different ways we can deal with this issue, but the issue still feels so big. Nobody's been involved in coming up with these solutions, and we all know when you're part of creating something, you can see how it gets from A to Z, from a seed to a plant, but if you just show up and you see a plant, you're like, there's no way this seed can be that plant, and you move on. But if you're there, you watch it, in a greenhouse in Germany, watch it grow, you're like, this can happen. So I think part of what happens in these situations is that when people are involved in creating a solution, because it's the issue they care about primarily, then they build some confidence in their ability to take on other things that don't seem so overwhelming, because now they've been through a process where they had some accomplishment. What are the consequences of coming in and determining from the outside how a community should respond to an issue?
A good participation, I would think.
education.
I think I think one of the key things you have to do is have people take ownership of what the solution is going to be. And it's difficult to do that if you come in and lay it on. And somehow you have to help them feel that they are part of the development of whatever solution they come up with. Otherwise, they're just going to sit back and let the experts do the program, and they become passive clients. And I think that's why it's so important to engage them from the beginning and be part of the definition of the problem and the solution.
And what's the consequence of having an expert provide the solution, expertise?
There's nobody from inside the community that's solving it. And if the expert's gone, then what do you do with the problem?
Most experts are temporarily funded. So if funding goes away, and your expert goes away, there's nobody who owns this solution, which again reinforces this. Now you're back here. Except, I think, damage has been done because you're back here more convinced that your community can't do anything, more convinced that you are poor and incapable, more convinced that you shouldn't trust your neighbors because this community is a primary rival. So sometimes this traditional approach of bringing in proven solutions, best practices, which were really only best practices in the place they happened. They might be promising practices for a place that's similar, but it might not be the best practice for that place, can actually do damage. And it's something you have to keep in mind. I wanted to tell you one more story from my own experience where I committed the sin of the public housing officials in Norfolk, Virginia. I was the deputy director at an organization called Sacramento Mutual Housing. We built multifamily housing apartments for families, so 3 to 5 bedroom apartments for people who were, their income is about 50 to 60% of the area median. And it was called mutual housing because one of the ideas was that residents would have some say in how the place was run. Anything that wasn't legally defined, the resident council would get to sort of make the house rules, if you will. So that meant part of mutual housing's mission was training leaders, training residents on how to run meetings and that kind of thing. And part of the big vision, what I was brought in, was to help them move from this sort of internal leadership process of running resident councils and making presentations to the board about how things were going at their property to helping folks deal with what was going on around their properties. So we talked to residents and surveyed residents and found that people felt very safe in their housing and very unsafe on the street right outside their housing, in the streets their kids walk to school on. Because most of the housing we built in fairly tough neighborhoods. We started hiring, instead of hiring resident service coordinators, which was kind of the rage at the time, we moved them along and started hiring community organizers who would go in and listen to people and talk to people and continue the resident councils and maintaining them, but and doing classes on running meetings, and people wanted to organize programs, you know, helping them think that through and giving them those skills. But really, their main job was to listen and hear what people might want to work on to help us spread what we had created in this housing to the neighborhood. And there was one called Gateway Gardens that when I first got hired and was driven around and introduced all the properties, I thought, well, this one's going to be great. We're going to really get to organize here because it was one lot in from a gas station and a self car wash, both of which were used for drug deals, controlled by a local gang. that was something that people weren't happy about, so we thought, well, we can organize around that and get the police involved in making those safer places for the neighborhood. And then in a sort of twist of stereotypes, you know, we had these apartments where the people who lived there were upstanding folks, but these single-family homes behind our apartments on an entire street had become investor-owned by people who were not, did not live in the area, and eventually word had gotten out, and almost every one of them was owned by people who were dealing drugs. They're not owned, lived in, rented by, or sublet, or triple sublet out. There was just a whole industry going on in the single-family homes that backed up to our housing. This is crazy, and they had worked on this before. I tried. It was in an unincorporated part of Sacramento, so you had the county structure trying to deal with the urban issue. But I thought, well, this, you know, certainly we got all these kids. We've got kind of one of those cinder block walls between these houses. And one of the complaints we heard was that when the police came and did a raid on the area, everybody in the homes, they didn't run out in the street. Where did they run?
Over the wall,
through our property, which was running around with kids and things. So just not a situation you want having people with guns and knives and drugs running through your property and then police chasing them. So I actually gave one of my less experienced organizers this property because I thought this is going to be so easy to get people together to stop these obviously untenable situations. And he was a great guy, and he had a master's in community development from UC Davis, and so he knew a lot. He just hadn't experienced a lot of these kind of situations. And I thought this would be an easy one for him to work on. And the woman who was our director of organizing, you know, agreed, and so they would have weekly meetings, but I would come in monthly to meet with the organizers to see what was happening at the different properties, and were we moving from having staff-run programs to resident-driven programs, and how is that progress coming, and doing this whole shift. And I would always ask, oh, what's going on with Gateway? You know, we should be having a press conference by now, or protesting at the sheriff's office, they're not giving us enough attention, or something. Brandon kept saying, well, what they want to do is they want to paint a mural on the wall. This property was, the residents there were a mix of Hmong folks. Sacramento's very high Hmong population from Southeast Asia, and African American and Mexican American folks. So they wanted to paint a mural that where they could each put their traditions in this mural on the wall. And I was like, oh, you know, that's cool, you know, but we got drug dealers over there, and we've got guys with guns jumping over the fence, and, you know, talk to them about that. So this went on for a few months, and there was no progress being made, and I finally decided Brandon just doesn't seem to know how to get people, especially, and this happens, people who come from cultures where taking on authority can get you killed. So, you know, hammering on the sheriff's office to pay more attention to our corner might not have been towards the top of their list. So I said, go ahead and do the mural thing, and we'll figure this other stuff out later. So people came together, did the mural, beautiful. They learned, they met each other. They started to connect across cultural lines. Part of the issue that had to be worked out in the whole mural project and some drainage problems was we had to move the community garden. Community garden, especially for the Hmong families, especially for the Hmong women elders, was very important. It's the one place that they grow food that they really knew what to do with. So, we, you know, worked on that. This is all getting filed in trivial stuff in my head. Then, what happened was, the next raid came. The guys weren't just jumping over a cinder block. Wow, what were they jumping over?
Mural.
And the way the community garden got shifted, they ran through the community garden. Now they wanted to do something about the houses. You know, and it was just like a 2x4 in the back of my head. I was like, duh, you know, should have So they ran with the mural early. That's what they wanted to do. But yeah, the mural brought people together, they made connections, they built relationships, they did this stuff on their own. And then the guys were dumb enough to run to the garden, which really pissed off the Hmong elder women, which is not a pretty sight. And you want to see spitting. And so that led to them deciding that they wanted to learn how to talk to the sheriff's office and learn how to do that. So if it's rats, it's rats. If it's murals, it's murals. The point is that if you want to build community, you start where people are at and with what they want to do and with the gifts they have to bring to that and help bring that to the top. And then it can go a lot of places.
Did they make progress in solving the problem?
Yes.
What did they do?
One meeting with the deputy sheriffs, explaining this was going on and that they weren't going to put up with it anymore. Mm-hmm. And a little more attention from the county board of supervisors on that block, so it got patrolled more regularly instead of just raids. It was an easy place for them to make arrests. If they let it go on long enough, they knew a raid, they could round up a bunch of people, a lot of arrests. And there's some pressure on law enforcement to do the quota thing. Engaging in conversations with the systems so that they needed to respond more to where the community was at instead of what their programs that they were supposed to do. That's about what it is. So how do we do this as congregations? Are there times when as congregations, as faith communities, we define in advance what our neighborhoods or communities need, or even maybe what the parishioners need? Do you have that experience? Give examples. You have an example?
Interim pastor. New pastor comes in and the whole community's programs.
How come?
That's the way the Lutheran do it.
Why does the community have to reorganize just because of a new pastor?
My limited experience, I'm fairly good as a church, but my limited experience is there's usually two factions in any congregation. And when there's a pastoral turnover, they have to find a new pastor. They form work groups and work within the work groups to get a new direction.
So, in that case, it sounds like the pastor was called with the intent that they would bring a new direction.
Well, the Lutherans do an interim. They never hire the interims.
Other examples?
I'm not sure this is what you're getting at, but our church is it's in the center of the city, it's not downtown, it's in the center of the city. And the church went over and asked the grade school and the junior high, which are close to the center of the city, what they could use from our assets as far as people. And they said, we need mentors, and we need flowers, and we need somebody to sit with the kids when they read. And so asking, then all these things got set up, and there's tons of programs, helping with fun night and being with the kids and one-on-one mentoring and knitting hats and mittens because the kids would come to school and not have any. So is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, I think that's a great example of this side of the equation where there was some conversation back and forth.
Oh, you were asked about the other side?
And therefore, I imagine a lot of people in your church are able to engage in that.
That's really neat.
Whereas if another approach had been used, you may have been told, the congregation may have been told, you know, we've decided education is important and our public education system is suffering and children are suffering from that. So we're going to help the school, whoever wants to help the school. So who signs up for that? You're going to get some people. Who are you going to get to sign up for the school assistance project?
Retired people?
Yeah, retired people. Which is people who feel comfortable with schools. People who feel like they have something to offer school. But not necessarily. necessarily the person who is great with flowers but didn't think they had anything to offer a school. So that kind of conversation can open up so many different doors that people can go through, as opposed to putting a big thing on the outside. Otherwise, Bob.
This is a different kind of situation, if I can move to it, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a congregation in a rural Minnesota area, a strong congregation, and it has sort of five connecting congregations with it, so that there are these six parishes, and they call it the United Lutheran Church in Christ or something like that. But there is a rift in the larger congregation, I suppose about maybe 900 people, 900, something like that. And it's over the Sexuality Act that was taken at the Church of Assembly. And there are there's a minority that is opposed to that action, and so they had a congregational vote, and they those in the minority wanted to present a petition that they would that congregation would leave the ELCA, and so that got voted down. But there is still that rift in the congregation, and people who are tense with one another over it. How would you go about trying to community build with that problem in that situation?
Well, if I knew for sure, I'd be charging the ELC a lot of money right now to go around and deal with those situations. But the ELC didn't have a lot of money. Every community has rifts. And that's one of the first things you learn when you start. In fact, when I got left hold and went to Sacramento, I was hired by this group called the Rural Community Assistance Corporation. Mind you, before I came to Holden, I'd been working in the south and west sides of Chicago, so I wasn't really sure why they hired me, but I didn't turn it down. I didn't get a job. So, but I asked them once I was sort of comfortable. What were you thinking? My boss said, well, you know, I wanted somebody with a community building approach, but in 3 months you come back and you tell me. And the answer was fairly simple, which was the rural communities function very similar to urban neighborhoods, but they're based on relationships as opposed to programs and services that suburban communities really clamor around. You can work with them if you understand who dumped who at the prom 30 years ago. Who likes this dentist and who likes that dentist, and what rivalry they might have. Those kinds of interpersonal things. There's rifts in every community. I would do it the same way I talked about with the rural communities that were, especially here in the Northwest, where telecommuting was taking off.
Mm-hmm.
There was newcomers and older folks, not older by age, but people who have been attached and grown up rural. We started with, you know, what do you like about this place? Who are you? What do you bring?
Mm-hmm.
And so they got to know each other around a lot of things. And therefore, in that context where we expanded, before they only knew each other where they met and even argued about the stoplight.
Mm-hmm.
The urban people felt like, this is crazy. There's no stop sign, no stop light. How do you avoid accidents? And the people who have been there forever, like, you just work it out. We've been doing this for years. That's the only way they knew each other, was around that issue. When they knew each other around many other issues, including dreams for their children, then that issue became a smaller part of their relationship. And therefore the rift didn't define the community anymore. This particular community I'm thinking of became defined about their common desire to create a waterfront and a river, a waterfront that would be enjoyable for people, that kids might want to come back and live there because it would be high quality of life, but also might draw people to their community to spend money as an economic development tool. So So that became more important for them to have conversations around that than around the difference over the stop sign and the stoplight didn't end, but it became less important. And I think that's what happens to us in the church a lot, as we find issues, language around God, what sexuality means for ordination, and we get stuck on those. I can't think of any stories where Jesus said, I'm going to call you together and we're going to discuss this issue and define my ministry by that. So I think the church actually has a lot to offer the world in the sense that we can be a safe place if we really believe in the grace of God to have those open conversations and open ourselves up to each other and then understand how to disagree in loving ways. When we go away from that, it's sort of like doing more damage. We not only become hurtful to each other, but entirely useless to the outside observer. So my work would focus on expanding how people build relationships. Which sort of leads to the last thing I wanted to do tonight, which was to have people think about how did Jesus build community? Think about the gospel stories.
Maybe an open topic.
Yeah.
Tolerance, acceptance of difference.
Yeah, a lot of acceptance of people he wasn't supposed to. Tax collectors, Samaritans, things like that.
He used a lot of parties.
He used a lot of parties.
Yeah.
Say more about that, Bob.
Well, I mean, as you read the Gospels, he's always going to someone's home for dinner, or he's gathering people to that crowd, 5,000, whatever it is, and they're fed. And it's interesting the Greek words used to describe how they would sit at table. Well, they didn't sit in chairs. They were on the ground, and if it was a real party, it was sort of lying on the ground. I mean, not
right.
Too much wine or anything, but just lying on the ground. That's the word that's frequently used for these gatherings of Jesus. So that's what I meant. It brought people together, and he brought them together around lines that broke down the traditional barriers between men and women, for example, and sinners like the tax collectors and, with the others.
Yeah. So he went into the rift, but the rift wasn't the issue, because they kept asking him all the time, why do you eat with these people? Why are these women here?
Right.
Why are these children here? He didn't say, I'm bringing children here because I believe in a diversity community. He was just doing it, asking about other things.
Well, sometimes it's important to say that, I think.
Yeah, well, he eventually had to almost all the time.
Yeah.
Back to sort of the disciple density issue, that they weren't getting it, so they had to keep asking, so they had to keep explaining. What else did he do? Other examples of Jesus building community.
He met people's needs. I don't know what was said over here, so I don't know if that was already said, but whether it's raising a child or healing, or he listened to the story and met their needs.
Yeah, so he went to where people were at. He usually had something to say about it that was entirely different than the story. He didn't say, I'm looking for a dead kid to raise, so I can prove that. But when asked, he engaged with those folks and then raised him a story. He asked a lot of questions. Especially if you look at Luke and Mark's versions. Lots and lots of questions that he would ask. The parables, many of them started with, why do you think the birds don't worry? I think that was part of how he built community. He let people struggle with these things. He's a rabbi. He could have said, here's the program, folks. Just keep going over it. pray in Jerusalem. Let's. That plan didn't work out so good. They didn't like it so much, but chased them out of there. But there was, as far as we know, the only program, you know, was to teach us to pray, which is what people commonly ask the prophet. You know, can you summarize your teachings for us? But he could have done that a lot different, a lot quicker. I just say, okay, here's my prayer. Now everybody go out and teach it. He could have told the disciples, I want you to come be teachers of this way of being. Or I want you to come learn to be healers. But they were fishermen. So he said, I'm going to teach how to fish for men. And he went to where they were already at, the gift they knew they had. He said, I can help you work with that in a different way. So I'd encourage you to read the gospel sometime, looking for at Jesus as a listener. We often are looking for what did he tell us. But usually in the context of the story, you'll see that sometimes between the lines, but sometimes right in the words, it's very clear that he's set up a situation where he's listening. Going to dinner at a tax collector's house. I don't imagine that conversation was him explaining the laws of tax collecting. The guy knew it, otherwise he wouldn't have gone up on the tree trying to listen to Jesus. He knew that. He didn't need that. I'm sure the conversation was a lot about what's your pain, what's your dreams, what do you want to be? Okay, go do that. Go give people the money back. So a lot of this work is simply around and kind of set up for a little bit in the next session. But community builders generally find that they can connect assets, they can connect people, they can build community by asking them and listening to them talk about their dreams, their concerns, and their gifts. The next couple sessions, we'll talk about where power works into that, and what the role of community organizers is in helping us do that. Well, thanks for coming tonight. I'll hang around for a little bit afterwards, and have a good evening.
Thank you.